This is Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. This is the third of three parts of Chapter 3, titled The Color of Justice. The Occupation, Policing the Enemy. The court's blind eye to race discrimination in the criminal justice system has been especially problematic in policing. Racial bias is the most acute at the point of entry into the system for two reasons: discretion and authorization. Although prosecutors as a group have the greatest power in the criminal justice system, police have the greatest discretion, discretion that is amplified in drug law enforcement. And unbeknownst to the general public, the Supreme Court has actually authorized race discrimination in policing rather than adopting legal rules banning it. Racially biased police discretion is key to understanding how the overwhelming majority of people who get swept into the criminal justice system in the war on drugs turn out to be black or brown, even though the police adamantly deny that they engage in racial profiling. In the drug war, police have discretion regarding whom to target, which individuals, as well as where to target, which neighborhoods or communities. As noted earlier, at least 10% of Americans violate drug laws every year, and people of all races engage in illegal drug activity at similar rates. With such an extraordinarily large population of offenders to choose from, decisions must be made regarding who should be targeted and where the drug war should be waged. From the outset, the drug war could have been waged primarily in overwhelmingly white suburbs or on college campuses. SWAT teams could have rappelled from helicopters in gated suburban communities and raided the homes of high school lacrosse players, known for hosting coke and ecstasy parties after the games. The police could have seized televisions, furniture, and cash from fraternity houses based on an anonymous tip that a few joints or a stash of cocaine could be found hidden in someone's dresser drawer. Suburban homemakers could have been placed under surveillance and subjected to undercover operations designed to catch them violating laws regulating the use and sale of prescription uppers. All of this could have happened as a matter of routine in white communities, but it did not. Instead, when police go looking for drugs, they look in the hood. Tactics that would be political suicide in an upscale white suburb are not even newsworthy in poor black and brown communities. So long as mass drug arrests are concentrated in impoverished urban areas, police chiefs have little reason to fear a political backlash, no matter how aggressive and warlike the efforts may be. And so long as the number of drug arrests increases, or at least remains high, federal dollars continue to flow in and fill the department's coffers. As one former prosecutor put it, it's a lot easier to go out to the hood, so to speak, and pick somebody up than to put your resources in an undercover operation in a community where there are potentially politically powerful people. The hypersegregation of black poor in ghetto communities has made the roundup easy. Confined to ghetto areas and lacking political power, the black poor are convenient targets. Douglas Massey in Nancy Denton's book, American Apartheid, documents how racially segregated ghettos were deliberately created by federal policy, not impersonal market forces or private housing choices. The enduring racial isolation of the ghetto poor has made them uniquely vulnerable in the war on drugs. What happens to them does not directly affect and is scarcely noticed by the privileged beyond the ghetto's invisible walls. Thus, it is here in the poverty-stricken, racially segregated ghettos, where the war on poverty has been abandoned and factories have disappeared, that the drug war has been waged with the greatest ferocity. SWAT teams are deployed here. Buy and bust operations are concentrated here. Drug raids of apartment buildings occur here. Stop and frisk operations occur on the streets here. Black and brown youth are the primary targets. It is not uncommon for a young black teenager living in a ghetto community to be stopped, interrogated, and frisked numerous times in the course of a month or even a single week, often by paramilitary units. Studies of racial profiling typically report the total number of people stopped and searched, disaggregated by race. These studies have led some policing experts to conclude that racial profiling is actually worse in white communities because the racial disparities in stop and search rates are much greater there. What these studies do not reveal, however, is the frequency with which any given individual is likely to be stopped in specific racially defined neighborhoods. The militarized nature of law enforcement in ghetto communities has inspired rap artists and black youth to refer to the police presence in the black communities as the occupation. In these occupied territories, many black youth automatically assume the position when a patrol car pulls up, knowing full well that they will be detained and frisked no matter what. This dynamic often comes as a surprise to those who have spent little time in ghettos. Craig Futterman, a law professor at the University of Chicago, reports that his students frequently express shock and dismay when they venture into those communities for the first time and witness the distance between abstract legal principles and actual practice. One student reported, following her ride along with Chicago police, "Each time we drove into a public housing project and stopped the car, every young black man in the area would almost reflexively place his hands up against the car and spread his legs to be searched, and the officers would search them. The officers would then get back into the car and stop in another project, and this would happen again. This repeated itself throughout the entire day. I couldn't believe it. This was nothing like we learned in law school, but it just seemed so normal for the police and the young men." Numerous scholars and many law enforcement officials attempt to justify the concentration of drug law enforcement resources in ghetto communities on the ground that it is easier for the police to combat illegal drug activity there. The theory is that black and Latino drug users are more likely than white users to obtain illegal drugs in public spaces that are visible to the police, and therefore it is more efficient and convenient for the police to concentrate their efforts on open-air drug markets in ghetto communities. Sociologists have been major proponents of this line of reasoning, pointing out that differential access to private space influences the likelihood that criminal behavior will be detected. Because poor people lack access to private space, often sharing small apartments with numerous family members or relatives, their criminal activity is more likely to be conducted outdoors. Concentrating law enforcement efforts in locations where drug activity will be more easily detected is viewed as a race-neutral organizational necessity. This argument is often buttressed by claims that most citizen complaints about illegal drug activity come from ghetto areas, and that the violence associated with the drug trades occurs in inner cities. These facts, drug war defenders claim, make the decision to wage the drug war almost exclusively in poor communities of color an easy and logical choice. This line of reasoning is weaker than it initially appears. Many law enforcement officials acknowledge that the demand for illegal drugs is so great and the lack of alternative sources of income so few in ghetto communities that if you take one dealer off the street, he'll be replaced within an hour. Many also submit that a predictable consequence of breaking up one drug ring is a slew of violence as others fight for control of the previously stabilized market. These realities suggest, if the past two decades of endless war somehow did not, that the drug war is doomed to fail. They also call into question the legitimacy of convenience as an excuse for the mass imprisonment of black and brown men in ghetto communities. Even putting aside such concerns, though, recent research indicates that the basic assumptions upon which the drug war defenses typically rest are simply wrong. The conventional wisdom that get-tough tactics are a regrettable necessity in poor communities of color and that efficiency requires the drug war to be waged in the most vulnerable neighborhoods turns out to be, as many have long suspected, nothing more than wartime propaganda, but not sound policy. Unconventional wisdom. In 2002, a team of researchers at the University of Washington decided to take the defenses of the drug war seriously, by subjecting the arguments to empirical testing in a major study of drug law enforcement in a racially mixed city, Seattle. The study found that, contrary to the prevailing common sense, the high arrest rates of African Americans in drug law enforcement could not be explained by the rates of offending, nor could they be explained by other standard excuses such as the ease and efficiency of policing open-air drug markets, citizen complaints, crime rates, or drug-related violence. The study also debunked the assertion that the white drug dealers deal indoors, making their criminal activity more difficult to detect. The authors found that it was untrue stereotypes about crack markets, crack dealers, and crack babies, not facts, that were driving discretionary decision-making by the Seattle Police Department. The facts were as follows. Seattle residents were far more likely to report suspected narcotics activities in residences, not outdoors, but police devoted their resources to open-air drug markets and to the one precinct that was least likely to be identified as the site of suspected drug activity and citizen complaints. In fact, although hundreds of outdoor drug transactions were recorded in predominantly white areas of Seattle, police concentrated their drug enforcement efforts in one downtown drug market where the frequency of drug transactions was much lower. In racially mixed open-air drug markets, black dealers were far more likely to be arrested than whites, even though white dealers were present and visible. And the department focused on overwhelmingly on crack, the one drug in Seattle more likely to be sold by African Americans, despite the fact that local hospital records indicated that overdose deaths involving heroin were more numerous than all overdose deaths for crack and powder cocaine combined. Local police acknowledged that no significant level of violence was associated with crack in Seattle, and that other drugs were causing more hospitalizations, but steadfastly maintained that their deployment decisions were non-discriminatory. The study's authors concluded, based on the review and analysis of the empirical evidence, that the Seattle Police Department's decisions to focus so heavily on crack, to the near exclusion of other drugs, and to concentrate its efforts on outdoor drug markets in downtown areas, rather than drug markets located indoors or in predominantly white communities, reflect a racialized conception of the drug problem. As the authors put it, the Seattle Police Department's focus on black and Latino individuals and on the drug most strongly associated with blackness suggests that law enforcement policies and practices are predicated on the assumption that the drug problem is in fact a black and Latino one, and that crack, the drug most strongly associated with urban blacks, is the worst. This racialized cultural script about who and what constitutes the drug problem renders illegal drug activity by whites invisible. White people, the study's authors observed, are simply not perceived as drug offenders by Seattle police officers. One might imagine that the facts described above would provide grounds for lawsuits challenging the Seattle Police Department's drug war tactics as a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and demanding reform. After all, obtaining reform through the city council or state legislature may seem unlikely, for black criminals are perhaps the most despised minority in the U.S. population. Few politicians will leap at the opportunity to support black people labeled criminals. Accordingly, a lawsuit may seem like the best option. The purpose of our Constitution, especially the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Guarantee, is to protect minority rights even when, or especially when, they're unpopular. So, shouldn't African American defendants be able to file a successful lawsuit demanding an end to these discriminatory practices, or challenge their drug arrests on the grounds that these law enforcement practices are unlawfully tainted by race? The answer is yes, they should, but no, they probably can't. As legal scholar David Cole has observed, the court has imposed nearly insurmountable barriers to persons challenging race discrimination at all stages of the criminal justice system. The barriers are so high that few lawsuits are even filed, notwithstanding shocking and indefensible racial disparities. Procedural hurdles, such as the standing requirement, have made it virtually impossible to seek reform of law enforcement agencies through the judicial process, even when the policies or practices at issue are illegal or plainly discriminatory. Adolph Lyons' attempt to ban the use of lethal chokeholds by the Los Angeles Police Department, LAPD, is a good example. Lyons, a 24-year-old black man, was driving his car in Los Angeles one morning when he was pulled over by four police officers for a burnt-out taillight. With guns drawn, police ordered Lyons out of his car. He obeyed. The officers told him to face the car, spread his legs, and put his hands on his head. Again, Lyons did as he was told. After the officers completed a pat-down, Lyons dropped his hands, prompting an officer to slam Lyons' hands back on his head. When Lyons complained that the car keys he was holding were causing him pain, the officer forced Lyons into a chokehold. He lost consciousness and collapsed. When he awoke, he was spitting up blood and dirt, had urinated and defecated, and had suffered permanent damage to his larynx. The officers issued a traffic ticket for the burnt-out taillight and released him. Lyons sued the city of Los Angeles for violation of his constitutional rights and sought, as a remedy, a ban against future use of chokeholds. By the time his case reached the Supreme Court, 16 people had been killed by police use of the chokehold, 12 of them black men. The Supreme Court dismissed the case, however, ruling that Lyons lacked standing to seek an injunction against the deadly practice. In order to have standing, the court reasoned, Lyons would have to show that he was highly likely to be subject to a chokehold again. Lyons argued that, as a black man, he had good reason to fear he would be stopped by the police for a minor traffic violation and subjected to the chokehold again. He had done nothing to provoke the chokehold. To the contrary, he had obeyed instructions and cooperated fully. Why wouldn't he believe he was at risk of being stopped and choked again? The court, however, ruled that in order to have standing, Lyons would have had not only to allege that he would have another encounter with police, but also to make the incredible assertion, either one, that all police officers in Los Angeles always choke any citizen with whom they have an encounter, whether for the purpose of arrest, issuing a citation, or for questioning, or two, that the city ordered or authorized the police to act in such a manner. Lyons did not allege race discrimination, but if he had, that claim would almost certainly have been a loser too. The court's ruling in Lyons makes it extremely difficult to challenge systemic race discrimination in law enforcement and obtain meaningful policy reform. For example, African Americans in Seattle who hope to end Seattle Police Department's discriminatory tactics through litigation would be required to prove that they plan to violate drug laws and that they will almost certainly face race discrimination by Seattle police officers engaged in drug law enforcement, in order to have standing to seek reform, i.e., just to get in the courthouse door. It is worthy of note that Lyons, the standard, does not apply to suits for damages, but any suggestion that litigants need not worry about policy reform because they can always sue for damages would be disingenuous, particularly as applied to race discrimination cases. Why? Neither the state nor the state police can be sued for damages. In a series of cases, the Supreme Court has ruled that the state and its offices are immune from federal suits for damages under the 11th Amendment to the Constitution, unless they consent, and the state can't be sued for damages for constitutional violations in state court either. City police departments, like the LAPD, are also typically off-limits. The court has ruled that a city police department cannot be sued for damages unless a specific city policy or custom can be identifying authorizing the illegal practice. Most cities, of course, do not have policies specifically authorizing illegal conduct, particularly race discrimination, and custom is notoriously difficult to prove. Accordingly, suing a city police department for damages is generally not an option. Yet, even if all of those hurdles can somehow be overcome, there's still the matter of proving a claim of race discrimination. As we've seen, to establish an equal protection violation, one must prove intentional discrimination, conscious racial bias. Law enforcement officials rarely admit to having acted for racial reasons, leaving most victims of discriminatory law enforcement without anyone to sue and without a claim that can be proven in court. But even if a plaintiff managed to overcome all of the procedural hurdles and prove that a police officer deliberately exercised his or her discretion on the basis of race, that still might not be enough. Race as a factor. The dirty little secret of policing is that the Supreme Court has actually granted the police the license to discriminate. This fact is not advertised by police departments because law enforcement officials know that the public would not respond well to this fact in the era of colorblindness. It is the sort of thing that is better left unsaid. Civil rights lawyers, including those litigating racial profiling cases, have been complicit in this silence, fearing that any acknowledgement that race-based policing is authorized by law would legitimate in the public mind the very practice they're hoping to eradicate. The truth, however, is this. At other stages of the criminal justice process, the court has indicated that overt racial bias necessarily triggers strict scrutiny, a concession that has not been costly, as very few law enforcement officials today are foolish enough to admit bias openly. But the Supreme Court has indicated that in policing, race can be used as a factor in discretionary decision-making. In United States v. Brignami-Ponce, the court concluded it was permissible under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment for the police to use race as a factor in making decisions about which motorists to stop and search. In that case, the court concluded that the police could take a person's Mexican appearance into account when developing reasonable suspicion that a vehicle may contain undocumented immigrants. The court said that the likelihood that any person of Mexican ancestry is an alien is high enough to make a Mexican appearance a relevant factor. Some commentators have argued that Brignami Ponce may be limited to the immigration context. The court might not apply the same principle to drug law enforcement. It is not obvious what the rational basis would be for limiting overt race discrimination by police to immigration. The likelihood that a person of Mexican ancestry is an alien could not be significantly higher than the likelihood that any random black person is a drug criminal. The court's quiet blessing of race-based traffic stops has led to something of an Orwellian public discourse regarding racial profiling. Police departments and highway patrol agencies frequently declare, "We do not engage in racial profiling," even though their officers routinely use race as a factor when making decisions regarding whom to stop and search. The justification for the implicit doublespeak, "We do not racial profile, we just stop people based on race," can be explained in part by the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. Because the Supreme Court has authorized the police to use race as a factor when making decisions regarding whom to stop and search, police departments believe that racial profiling exists only when race is the sole factor. Thus, if race is one factor but not the only factor, then it doesn't really count as a factor at all. The absurdity of this logic is evidenced by the fact that police almost never stop anyone solely because of race. A young black male wearing baggy pants standing in front of his high school surrounded by a group of similarly dressed black friends may be stopped and searched because police believe he looks like a drug dealer. Clearly, race is not the only reason for that conclusion. Gender, age, attire, and location play a role. The police would likely ignore an 85-year-old black man standing in the same spot, surrounded by a group of elderly black women. The problem is that although race is rarely the sole reason for a stop or search, it is frequently a determinative reason. A young white male wearing baggy pants standing in front of his high school and surrounded by his friends might well be ignored by police officers. It might never occur to them that a group of young white kids might be dealing dope in front of their high school. Similarly situated people inevitably are treated differently when police are granted permission to rely on racial stereotypes when making discretionary decisions. Equally important, though, the sole factor test ignores the ways in which seemingly race-neutral factors, such as location, operate in a highly discriminatory fashion. Some law enforcement officials claim that they would stop and search white kids wearing baggy jeans in the ghetto. That would be suspicious. It just so happens they're rarely there. Subjecting people to stops and searches because they live in high-crime ghettos cannot be said to be truly race-neutral, given that the ghetto itself was constructed to contain and control groups of people defined by race. Even seemingly race-neutral factors, such as prior criminal history, are not truly race-neutral. A black kid arrested twice for possession of marijuana may be no more of a repeat offender than a white frat boy who regularly smokes pot in his dorm room. But because of his race and his confinement to a racially segregated ghetto, the black kid has a criminal record while the white frat boy, because of his race and relative privilege, does not. Thus, when prosecutors throw the book at black repeat offenders, or when police stalk ex-offenders and subject them to regular frisks and searches on the grounds that it makes sense to watch criminals closely, they're often exacerbating racial disparities created by the discretionary decision to wage the war on drugs almost exclusively in poor communities of color. Defending against claims of racial bias in policing is easy. Because race is never the only reason for a stop or search, any police officer with a fifth grade education will be able to cite multiple non-racial reasons for initiating an encounter, including any number of the so-called indicators of drug trafficking discussed in Chapter 2, such as appearing too nervous or too calm. Police officers, like prosecutors, are highly adept at offering race-neutral reasons for actions that consistently disadvantage African Americans. Whereas prosecutors claim they strike black jurors not because of their race but because of their hairstyle, police officers have their own stock excuses. E.g., "Your Honor, we didn't stop him because he's black, we stopped him because he failed to use his turn signal at the right time." Or, "It wasn't just because he was black, it was also because he seemed nervous when he saw the police car." Judges are just as reluctant to second-guess an officer's motives as they are to second-guess prosecutors. So long as officers refrain from uttering racial epithets, and so long as they show the good sense not to say, "The only reason I stopped him was because he's black," courts generally turn a blind eye to patterns of discrimination by the police. Studies of racial profiling have shown that police do, in fact, exercise their discretion regarding whom to stop and search in the drug war in a highly discriminatory manner. Not only do police discriminate in their determinations regarding where to wage the war, but they also discriminate in their judgments regarding whom to target outside of the ghetto's invisible walls. The most famous of these studies were conducted in New Jersey and Maryland in the 1990s. Allegations of racial profiling in federally funded drug interdiction operations resulted in numerous investigations and comprehensive data demonstrating a dramatic pattern of racial bias in highway patrol stops and searches. These drug interdiction programs were the brainchild of the DEA, part of the federally funded program known as Operation Pipeline. In New Jersey, the data showed that only 15% of all drivers on the New Jersey Turnpike were racial minorities, yet 42% of all stops and 73% of all arrests were of black motorists, despite the fact that blacks and whites violated traffic laws at almost exactly the same rate. While radar stops were relatively consistent with the percentage of minority violators, discretionary stops made by officers involving drug interdiction resulted in double the number of stops of minorities. A subsequent study conducted by the Attorney General of New Jersey found that searches on the turnpike were even more discriminatory than the initial stops. 77% of all consent searches were of minorities. The Maryland studies produced similar results. African Americans comprised only 17% of the drivers along a stretch of I-95 outside of Baltimore, yet they were 70% of those who were stopped and searched. Only 21% of all drivers along that stretch of highway were racial minorities, Latinos, Asians, and African Americans, yet those groups comprised nearly 80% of those pulled over and searched. What most surprised many analysts was that in both studies, whites were actually more likely than people of color to be carrying illegal drugs or contraband in their vehicles. In fact, in New Jersey, whites were almost twice as likely to be found with illegal drugs or contraband as African Americans, and five times as likely to be found with contraband as Latinos. Although whites were more likely to be guilty of carrying drugs, they were far less likely to be viewed as suspicious, resulting in relatively few stops, searches, and arrests of whites. The former New Jersey Attorney General dubbed this phenomenon the circular illogic of racial profiling. Law enforcement officials, he explained, often point to the racial composition of our prisons and jails as justification for targeting racial minorities. But the empirical evidence actually suggested the opposite conclusion was warranted. The disproportionate imprisonment of people of color was, in part, a product of racial profiling, not a justification for it. In the years following the release of the New Jersey and Maryland data, dozens of other studies of racial profiling have been conducted. A brief sampling. In Volusia County, Florida, a reporter obtained 148 hours of video footage documenting more than 1,000 highway stops conducted by state troopers. Only 5% of the drivers on the road were African American or Latino, but more than 80% of the people stopped and searched were minorities. In Illinois, the state police initiated a drug interdiction program known as Operation Valkyrie that targeted Latino motorists. While Latinos comprised less than 8% of the Illinois population and took fewer than 3% of the personal vehicle trips in Illinois, they comprised approximately 30% of the motorists stopped by drug interdiction officers for discretionary offenses, such as failure to signal a lane change. Latinos, however, were significantly less likely than whites to have illegal contraband in their vehicles. A racial profiling study in Oakland, California in 2001 showed that African Americans were approximately twice as likely as whites to be stopped and three times as likely to be searched. Pedestrian stops, too, have been the subject of study and controversy. The New York Police Department released statistics in February 2007 showing that during the prior year, its offices stopped an astounding 508,540 people, an average of 1,398 per day, who were walking down the street, perhaps on their way to the subway, grocery store, or bus stop. Often the stops included searches for illegal drugs or guns, searches that frequently required people to lie face down on the pavement, or stand spread-eagled against a wall while police officers aggressively groped all over their bodies while bystanders watched or walked by. The vast majority of those stopped and searched were racial minorities, and more than half were African American. The NYPD began collecting data on pedestrian stops following the shooting of Amadou Diallo, an African immigrant who died in a hail of police bullets on the front steps of his own home in February 1999. Diallo was followed to his apartment building by four white police officers, members of the elite street crime unit, who viewed him as suspicious and wanted to interrogate him. They ordered him to stop, but according to officers, Diallo did not respond immediately. He walked a bit further to his apartment building, opened the door, then retrieved his wallet, probably to produce identification. The officers said they thought the wallet was a gun and fired 41 times. Amadou Diallo died at the age of 22. He was unarmed and had no criminal record. Diallo's murder sparked huge protests, resulting in a series of studies commissioned by the Attorney General of New York. The first study found that African Americans were stopped 6 times more frequently than whites, and that stops of African Americans were less likely to result in arrests than stops of whites, presumably because blacks were less likely to be found with drugs or other contraband. Although the NYPD attempted to justify the stops on the grounds that they were designed to get guns off the street, stops by the street crime unit, the group of officers who supposedly are specially trained to identify gun-toting thugs, yielded a weapon in only 2.5% of all stops. Rather than reducing reliance on stop-and-frisk tactics, following the Diallo shooting and the release of this disturbing data, the NYPD dramatically increased its number of pedestrian stops and continued to stop and frisk African Americans at grossly disproportionate rates. The NYPD stopped 5 times more people in 2005 than in 2002, the overwhelming majority of whom were African American or Latino. In Los Angeles, mass stops of young African American men and boys resulted in the creation of a database containing the names, addresses, and other biographical information of the overwhelming majority of young black men in the entire city. The LAPD justified its database as a tool for tracking gang or gang-related activity. However, the criterion for inclusion in the database is so notoriously vague and discriminatory. Having a relative or friend in a gang and wearing baggy jeans is enough to put you on what the ACLU calls a blacklist. In Denver, displaying any 2 of a list of attributes, including slang, clothing of a particular color, pagers, hairstyles, or jewelry, earns youth a spot in the Denver Police Gang database. In 1992, citizen activism led to an investigation, which revealed that 8 out of every 10 people of color in the entire city were on the list of suspected criminals.
The end of an era. The litigation that swept the nation in the 1990s challenging racial profiling practices has nearly vanished. The news stories about people being stopped and searched on their way to church or work or school have faded from the evening news. This is not because the problem has been solved or because the experience of being stopped, interrogated, and searched on the basis of race has become less humiliating, alienating, or demoralizing as time has gone by. The lawsuits have disappeared because, in a little-noticed case called Alexander v. Sandoval, decided in 2001, the Supreme Court eliminated the last remaining avenue available for challenging racial bias in the criminal justice system. Sandoval was not, on its face, even about criminal justice. It was a case challenging the Alabama Department of Public Safety's decision to administer state driver's license examinations only in English. The plaintiffs argued that the department's policy violated Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and its implementing regulations, because the policy had the effect of subjecting non-English speakers to discrimination based on their national origin. The Supreme Court did not reach the merits of the case, ruling instead that the plaintiffs lacked the legal right even to file a lawsuit. It concluded that Title VI does not provide a private right of action to ordinary citizens and civil rights groups, meaning that victims of discrimination can no longer sue under the law. The Sandoval decision virtually wiped out racial profiling litigation nationwide. Nearly all of the cases alleging racial profiling in drug law enforcement were brought pursuant to Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and its implementing regulations. Title VI prohibits federally funded programs or activities from discriminating on the basis of race, and regulations employ a disparate impact test for discrimination, meaning that plaintiffs could prevail in claims of race discrimination without proving discriminatory intent. Under the regulations, a federally funded law enforcement program or activity is unlawful if it has a racially discriminatory impact and if that impact cannot be justified by law enforcement necessity. Because nearly all law enforcement agencies receive federal funding in the drug war, and because drug war tactics such as pretext stops and consent searches have a grossly discriminatory impact and are largely ineffective, plaintiffs were able to argue persuasively that the tactics could not be justified by law enforcement necessity. In 1999, for example, the ACLU of Northern California filed a class action lawsuit against the California Highway Patrol, CHP, alleging that its highway drug interdiction program violated Title VI of the Civil Rights Act because it relied heavily on discretionary pretext stops and consent searches that are employed overwhelmingly against African American and Latino motorists. During the course of the litigation, the CHP produced data that showed African Americans were twice as likely and Latinos three times as likely to be stopped and searched by its officers as were whites. The data further showed that consent searches were ineffective. Only a tiny percentage of the discretionary searches resulted in the discovery of drugs or other contraband. Yet, thousands of black and brown motorists were subjected to baseless interrogations, searches, and seizures as a result of having committed a minor traffic violation. The CHP entered into a consent decree that provided for a 3-year moratorium on consent searches and pretext stops statewide, and the collection of comprehensive data on the race and ethnicity of motorists stopped and searched by the police, so that it would be possible to determine whether discriminatory practices were continuing. Similar results were obtained in New Jersey as a result of landmark litigation filed against the New Jersey State Police. After Sandoval, these cases can no longer be brought under Title VI by private litigants. Only the federal government can sue to enforce Title VI's anti-discrimination provisions, something it has neither the inclination nor the capacity to do in most racial profiling cases due to its limited resources and institutional reluctance to antagonize local law enforcement. Since the war on drugs, private litigants represented by organizations such as the ACLU have been at the forefront of racial profiling litigation. Those days, however, have come to an end. The racial profiling cases that swept the nation in the 1990s may well be the last wave of litigation challenging racial bias in the criminal justice system that we see for a very long time. The Supreme Court has now closed the courthouse doors to claims of racial bias at every stage of the criminal justice process, from stops and searches to plea bargaining and sentencing. The system of mass incarceration is now, for all practical purposes, thoroughly immunized from claims of racial bias. Staggering racial disparities in the drug war continue, but rarely make the news. The Obama administration has indicated it supports abolition of the 100-to-1 disparity in sentencing for crack versus powder cocaine, the most obvious and embarrassing example of racial bias in a system that purports to be colorblind. But that disparity is just the tip of the iceberg. As noted in Chapter 2, this system depends primarily on the prison label, not prison time. What matters most is who gets swept into this system of control and then ushered into an undercast. The legal rules adopted by the Supreme Court guarantee that those who find themselves locked up and permanently locked out due to the drug war are overwhelmingly black and brown.